have before you the production team for Chekhov's Seagull, which opens on October 20th. I just erased the blackboard. It's a common background exterior shared by Miss Potter and me, since we're both graduates of Western University and have long belonged to that particular mafia. One of our teachers there, who had a profound influence on all of us, Lee Mitchell, said we never begin a class session without erasing the blackboard. Always upstage you the work from the preceding class. So we have just shared that. When I arrived at Northwestern in 1947, I couldn't afford a school from then because I didn't have the money. It was a very expensive school, but 2 years in the Army during the Second World War made it possible for me to go back and be at the school I really wanted to be at, where I knew there would be an extraordinary faculty. Joan Potter had just finished when I got there, so we didn't know each other in school, but people were still talking about her in the program, and they continued to talk about her for years, and I have not stopped talking about her ever since we met in Lee Strasberg's private classes and worked together for a couple of years with Lee, establishing a lifetime friendship. Joan has acted, and she is a superb actress for me on three occasions. Wonderful roles, Blanche in Streetcar, a new play that we enjoyed producing together, Leonora by Murray Bloom, in which she played the lead, and Mary Tyrone in Long Day's Journey in the Night. We also acted together, a great privilege for me to act with her, in a two-hander by Charles Dyer called Mother Adams. She's a wonderful actress and an equally wonderful teacher of acting. Her permanent position is in the training program at SUNY Purchase, New York State University of New York at Purchase, just north of the city, where she has been for many years now. I don't want to count them. Since we were colleagues together at SMU, teaching side by side in that program, I think for 4 or 5 years, 5 years before she went up to Purchase. So this is obviously a lifetime friend and colleague whom I cherish. I regard her as a supreme teacher and actress. She has worked as a director as well, directing Glass Menagerie for the Shaw Festival in Niagara, Three Sisters for the Bloomsburg Ensemble in Pennsylvania. She has a longtime passion for Chekhov. She acted twice, perhaps, in the Cherry Orchard Road on across, once at least,
this one.
Mm-hmm. Just once, Madame Ranevsky, mm-hmm. In the Cherry Orchard. I acted Trigorin for Albina twice, in a production at Northwestern and another production at her summer theater in Eagle, Pennsylvania. And our Jacobian roots are in Albina's teaching. She was certainly one of the most important American theater artists in her work on Chekhov, and has influenced hundreds of students. Obviously, her two outstanding students are Jack Clay and Joan Potter. And with that base, I am now ready to let her take over and share with Robert Dahlstrom her set designer and Sarah Nash Gates, her costume designer. Please give her a warm welcome. It can't be warm enough.
Oh, you're gonna follow that. Hi.
precious introduction. I don't know how to follow it, but we'll start. I'm delighted that these two folks are here. When you go to work on any play, you start in space somewhere with things that kind of say things to you, and you hope that you are going to meet a kindred soul. I feel that with Bob, and I certainly feel it with Sarah, that from the moment we began on this play, it was an extraordinary meeting of the minds. Not always agreeing, and sometimes not understanding this gentleman, it's miles ahead, but at least there was something that was organically going to surround the production. And that's always what one longs and hopes for. And I think that's the great advantage of working in the theaters in the university structure, as opposed to working in New York, where you have to serve the producer, you have to serve the successful requirements of production before you can consider the artistic choices. I'm just going to give you a little brief, run through about Chekhov, because I'm afraid that Chekhov isn't read very frequently in the high school or colleges, and there are just certain things that I think you ought to know, because the life was quite remarkable, and I would hope also that you would find the opportunity to read the plays and to read a biography, to begin to think about this man, because he is very significant in the period that brought us into our work in this century in the United States, and influenced teaching, directing, and acting all really around the world. He was born in 1860 in a small to medium town called Taganrog, which is on the Black Sea. At 13, like some of you, he was already writing little sketches for his family to produce. I was outrageous. I did all that sort of thing, Christmas sketches and all that sort of thing with my cousins. We were dreadful, but it was great fun. At 16, the family had to move to Moscow, because the father went absolutely bankrupt. And this young man assumed the full responsibility at the age of 16 for caring for his entire family. To do that, he began to write. And he wrote, first off, things that were rather particularly farcical, comical kinds of sketches, because they sold through the news, through the journals of the day. He began his studies in medicine. By the time he was 18, he had written a full-length play which no longer exists. I often wonder if that's the play that Tupolev puts in the stove at the end of Act 4 in The Seagull. By 21, he had written Platonov. Not terribly successful, but that was recently adapted, some of you know, as Wild Honey, and brought over by the Royal Shakespeare Company. By 1895, when he began work on The Seagull, he had been a doctor for 10 years. He had a double focus. He had to write in order to put himself through the university to provide food for his family. And the writing now was a mixture of both short stories and beginning work on plays. When he came to write The Seagull, there's a significance about his choice to me that I think you would all grasp. He could copy, if he chose to be just successful, the forms that were prevalent at the time. There was a well-made play which had come over from Europe, and productions were able to be seen. And then there were the plays, which we still have to this day, who are done, the plays that are done for the stars. And neither of those styles appealed to him, because even in the plays that he had not done successfully, he had begun to find a voice of his own, a path, a form. And in The Seagull, you hear that phrase over and over, the young man is looking for new forms. But new forms have to be right for the individual. If you're going to do anything new, don't make it any remnant of anybody else's choices. They have to be your own, intensely personal. And that is what The Seagull begins with, an intensely personal set of facts, experiences, observations from his life and from the associations that he had in both the literary world and in his private life and in his life also as a doctor. An extraordinary kind of humanity had evolved. And you'll find that in the play, and you'll find also a marvelous comic objectivity. The plays are comedies. How do we make a play about a young man who is in such despair over trying to become a creative person that he takes his own life? How do we make that into a comedy? Well, it's remarkable, the achievement, because he had an unerring ear for ordinary speech, for all of the details that make up our everyday lives. And while, yes, he's writing about Russians, we have immediate recognition. We are seeing aspects of ourselves, aspects of our own lives. The first production of the play was a total disaster. It was unfortunately given to a company. They had 6 rehearsals. They pulled together a set from old pieces of other shows, and they put it on, and it was supposed to have been done by one of the reigning comic actresses. Fortunately, she didn't do it, but even so, it was dreadful. He was shattered, and it was 2 years later that a company was forming which was to profoundly influence the thinking about the theater, the Moscow Art Theater, with Stanislavski and Nemirov, Danchenko. Danchenko being the artistic director, Stanislavski being the actor, teacher, the person who was in Chekhov's own way asking questions about what was wrong with the theater. Why, when he came home from the theater, had he not experienced anything? And that word experience, to be able to experience what the characters are going through, aligned him with Chekhov, because it was that Chekhov was hoping to find. He apparently attended rehearsals, and he gave the most meticulous notes. If someone wasn't really talking, he interrupted and asked them to begin again. I must say I had the same experience with Lee, which was quite remarkable, as we worked on The Three Sisters. And I was fortunate enough to get to play that role for 3 weeks in New York. But I also watched him work through all the rehearsals, both for the New York production and the London production. Lots of wild tales I'll tell you on another occasion. But the kind of work that was done on that was always to start with talking, really talking. What happens, I think, in the professional theater, and it lingers in our professional theater to this day, is that we have We take home line readings. We don't take home people. Chekhov wants us to take home people. A moment that speaks to you. It can be a moment where it's utterly silent, where not a single voice is spoken. It can be an empty stage and a sound off. It can be someone sitting quietly weeping. He had ears and a mind to perceive the choreography of life that was not just realistic, but had an artistry to what it was to become. Marvelous example that he said, when someone said they wanted to put this in and that in and that in, he said, I paraphrase it, if you have a painting, you don't put a real nose in it. And that is a very quick sort of grasp of the mind. He was after, I like to think of the plays as a piece of music. And as I said to the directors the other day, I come to it as I come to a piece of music that I do not know, I have to work and work and work till it says something to me. It's a process that is terribly important. And in the professional theater, it's never allowed. You've got so many weeks to do this. Learn your lines. If you're going for an audition, hear your sides, kid. Come on in, read, bing, 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 right? There's no process that allows something to happen within you, within the center of you. That's why when I come to Chekhov, it is such an experience. Poor Jack, when I came to do Mary Tyrone, I had the same experience. And I sit sometimes, I just weep, and then I go on, and things begin to take, and I begin to observe sounds and this and that and the other thing, and eventually things began to sort of stew about, and I begin not having preset anything, but having asked certain questions. And the questions that you always have to ask, of course, as you start, you've got to find the space in which this play will live and breathe. And you have to find the characters and those statements, the artistic statements for the characters, who will live and breathe. I just want to briefly go back to the acting style, because it is important for us to keep track of, and then I want to pass to these two lovely folks about this matter of putting the life, drawing the life out of Chekhov, extracting in our terms, for us, an immediacy of experience. The acting work of Stanislavski has had a profound influence. There are those who have maligned it. There are those who quote the English quote that he was dreadful. He ruined the plays, etc., etc. Well, yes, as a director, Chekhov did have problems with him, but Chekhov gave the Moscow art the rest of his glorious plays. Four major plays. And when he died at the age of 44 in 1904, the Moscow art had produced those with great distinction. And we look to do those plays now whenever we can. They are absolutely eloquent. I guess the Three Sisters is to be done in town here. Uncle Vanya, and of course the Cherry Orchard. So, a word to you to go and see any of those, anywhere that you can, and see what is going on. The acting style itself came to this country, and the workshop began on the West Coast. Maria Auspenskaya and Michael Chekhov. And then in New York, of course, it was the group theater and the work of Lee Strasberg and eventually the work of the Actors Studio. And all of the exercise work, which Jack knows so very well and does with his students here, has made it possible, it seems to me, to get into where the acting needs to be for this particular production of it. And I am very, very pleased to have this cast. It is an extraordinary gift. You have to have people who can perceive what it is to talk, to share from a center, to share feelings, to experience moment to moment to moment what the life of the play is. And the classes in New York, of course, some are taught at the studios, some are taught in the city by people who do all of the basic exercises. And one way or another, most of the significant actors in our country, and some also in England, certainly have been profoundly influenced by this notion that it isn't enough to represent, to indicate, to show and tell. It is a demand of you to share with the people who have bought the tickets something from the center for them to take home for a lifetime. I know you've been to the theater in New York many, many times. I could tell you right now the people that affected me profoundly. Lorette Taylor in The Glass Menagerie. Jessica Tandy in Streetcar. Brando in Streetcar. Lee Cobb in Death of a Salesman. Mildred Dunnick in Death of a Salesman. Colleen Dewhurst in the marvelous O'Neill, that last O'Neill that she did, Moon for the Misbegotten. There are just those glorious moments where you say all time stops and you have been part of that moment. You have, your heart has been touched. So that quality is what we're in search of. And the paradox is, of course, in this acting style, that it's not just enough to be real, it's not enough to be natural. The most meticulous detailing has to happen, both on the part of the director and the actors. The paradox always that it must seem to happen for the first time, but everything is discovered and planned. I see nodding heads. So it demands just as much style, just as much investment in the whole range of the techniques of acting as anything I know. And I think it is the same for the director, and it is the same for the designers. I would like to pass to them now and have them tell you what they have covered for us, because it is very, very special.
No. Oh, after you.
After you, my dear Alphonse. There's another designer who should be down here, too, Roberta Russell.
Where are absolutely, Roberta.
The lighting. All right. She's as much a part of this as we are.
Absolutely.
The ushers have left in your pews some Xeroxes of these sketches. I hate show-and-tell sessions, because somebody holds up something which is too small to see and talks about it as if you could see it. So there are five sets of material around somewhere, and if you want to get those to someone who is interested, please do so. We're not doing The Seagull in the kind of theater for which it was written. This is not a picture frame theater at all. We're doing it in the penthouse. I'm very pleased with the decision to be doing it in the penthouse. That happens to be a space to which I'm particularly addicted. I like the feeling of theater in that room. I also like working in that room because there's an authenticity to that space that I find very exciting. It's like going into the first Gothic cathedral. There's something about the first one of its kind that has a certain authority that affects the work that's done there, and that, as you all know, is the first of its kind. It's a very peculiar room. which makes very peculiar demands. First of all, let's say what we can't do in there. Chekhov wants the background for the first act to be the distant vista of the lake. The background for the first act, as the second and the third and the fourth in the penthouse, is a not very distant audience on the other side of the space. So pictorial theater cannot happen in that room. What can happen in that room is an evocation, with luck, touch wood if you can find it, is an evocation of an atmosphere that lets you feel the vista while you're actually looking at actors and across to other people who are looking at actors. What becomes most important there is the acting moment, the connections that the characters make, and the connection with one another, and the connections that they make with the audience. What a scenic designer or a lighting designer can do in there is to reinforce that with such kind of specific information as will not get between viewer and doer. We've tried to find some way of getting an exterior atmosphere for the first two acts instead of by supplying a vista of the lake in the distance, by supplying trees overhead. And we'll keep our fingers crossed and see how that that works for us. Another thing we have had to adapt to do it, to perform the play in that space, is the whole notion of the little stage. There's a great deal of talk about the curtain. Trepliev is very happy that he has rigged a curtain. For him, a curtain is what makes a theater. Well, we can't have a curtain there, because if we do, a quarter of the audience, which is on one side of that curtain, can't see anything else until the curtain rises, which is well into the first act. So we're trying to devise ways of doing with lights something that says the play is now beginning. Lights light the area, the acting area. So I think we have the first kerosene and maple stalk box booms which have ever been seen in the Western Theater. That's what these little objects are here. Trepliev obviously saw the Ninth Boston Truck of Corinth's line and decided that box boom lighting is what was theatrical. Fairly low angle side lighting. So we provide places for it to look like it's coming from, and Roberta provides places where it's actually coming from to light the stage for the little play. And you can see the trees overhead. There is one intermission in the show between Acts 2 and Acts 3, so we've got two internal shifts. A good deal of the design has been predicated on making those two internal shifts go rapidly, so that they're very minor pauses rather than something the length of the last war that you can recall. To get from Act 1 to Act 2, what was the little stage gets a thingamajigger, like one of those twig constructions that goes around the trunk of a very large tree to make it into a tree bench. Okay? So we get two variations on an exterior scene. Then for the third and fourth act, two variations on interior scene. There are a couple of things that Chekhov calls for that we simply have not yet discovered satisfactory analogs for in that space. Trepliev has to put a chair under a door handle to wedge a door shut so that people cannot get into the room. That is something that demands either a rewrite, for which Mr. Chekhov is temporarily unavailable, or it demands a rather elaborate live sound cue, which takes place out of our range of vision. This is sort of a compound. We've not found a good equivalent there. But we're doing what we can to see how that moment works, and we'll see where evolution takes us. So the problem is to provide the specific things that the actors need, things which seem to be, while they may be unfamiliar to us, familiar to the characters and usable by the characters, and then such atmospheric information as is
below the, at the bottom of the range of vision, or at the top of the range of vision. So the center area, when you're looking straight ahead, what you see is actors. Actors and that very important factor, either in the round or in the thrust stage, the rest of the audience. And here we get an interesting fusion between Chekhov's ideas about observed life inside a frame, inside of which we choose everything, and the kind of theater that Tyrone Guthrie talks about, particularly in his descriptions of the first thrust stage performances of which he was aware, which occurred in a renovated Presbyterian assembly hall in Edinburgh, Scotland, where theater is what is done in the midst of the congregation. And he chooses the word not only because it was a remodeled church, but because of what he thought about the audience. That act, which can become a sacramental act, which takes place in the middle of the congregation. That kind of excitement can happen, and with luck, will happen in the penthouse. Sir?
Yeah, well, for me, designing Chekhov, I think what Jonas had been saying about the characters, that's one of the great treats of working with Chekhov, is you get to know all these people so very well, and I really like all these people. They all have their foibles. They're just like us in that nobody's perfect at all, but everybody has something about them that is very human, and they're very funny. And I really do think I read Chekhov and chuckle. And so for me to work on this is very pleasant in terms of designing. And Joan and I had talked, and we met and reached an understanding of what approach she was going to be using with the various characters. And I made my designs, and I made sketches and sent them to Joan, and, you know, the way a costume designer is supposed to do. And then I had to get into the reality of how do you accommodate somewhere between 40 and 50 costumes. The challenge of Chekhov is there are four acts. There are always four different locations. There are four different times of year. There are four different. There's a two-year gap as well, so that everybody has to change their clothes, and that is the bane of a costume designer's existence. You know. And what we found again is, as Bob was saying, that, and as you go hunting, which means you can't make everything. And you need to find in the various costume stocks around town things you can borrow. So yes, we can make a few things, but most of what we're going to be, and you'll be seeing on stage, are from costume stocks. They're being recycled. Is to find the equivalent of what we agreed upon so that we're maintaining the spirit or the intent of the design, although some of the specifics might change. And just as an example, you can't see it much from here, but Shamrayev's coat is not going to be brown. The coat we found that has the same kind of quality and rough texture and so on is green. So you will see a green coat even though the drawing is brown. That kind of example of trying to keep your eye open for a garment that not only is going to fit the actor that you've got, but that maintains the intent of the design as established by our work together. And then the other thing that was interesting is we found, I did one design, and for Madame Arkadin in the third act, and it was a dress. And as Joan thought more about working on this production, she said, well, really, what I'd really love is how about a suit?
and so she can take the jacket off for the love scene. So it got converted into a suit. But the same feel, again, is there. The silhouette is there, the same lace ornamentation, and so on, for Vadimar Cotton is there. But to evolve clothes that then serve the moments that the actors are working on, the moments that Joan has been describing, and can hopefully make those moments more alive for all of you, for all of the audiences. And that's really where I think of this project as dealing with individual costumes in a way. Sometimes when some productions, you're dealing with something where you're perhaps maybe working in a color scheme, a very limited palette. You're looking at a very big picture. And I think part of this is in part because it is in the penthouse, you're so much closer to the actors that I've always thought on this particular design that I'm working with these individual components that then together are going to make the picture, as opposed to thinking about what the big picture is and then breaking it down into what the individual actors might be wearing as part of that picture, which is a little different sort of point of view. Well, I guess that's a little overview, summary.
Should I ask Roberta to say something?
I would, yes. I just wanted to add, because the music of Chekhov is not just actors' set costume text. It's a whole choreography of all of the elements that go to make up the moments. And that's where the lighting is so critical, and the lighting, the first act, is such a beautiful one that would be a challenge to do. And then Paul Taylor is doing the sound for us, and those sound cues are terribly important. And they each of those contributions, the whole thing works then to form a mosaic that gives us this picture of the play, our picture of the play. Do you want to say something?
No.
About but I've worked with you also with that same kind of sensitivity. I think we've had good conversations, good talks about the quality. The lighting is terribly difficult in the penthouse, and it's a real challenge to try to get certain of the texture in there that you want. Texture is a very important word for me, always. There's texture in this, there's texture in Sarah's costumes, there'll be texture in the lights, and texture in the acting. And it makes the difference to me between something that is not quite perceived as a total and something that is just not solved. You just go by this. You don't really understand it, so you're just not going to stroke this in. I just wanted to just touch for a moment on the themes, because the theme of the play, the themes of the play are terribly, terribly important. And it seems to me they're very appropriate for a training program. And I go back to the introduction and the fact that here was a man struggling to become a major artist. You're going to hear Trigorin talk about the suffering and the angst of creative writing. And you can substitute. All of you are wanting to be artists in the theater, right? You can just substitute there. The torture, the anxiety, the occasional joy of what it is to really be an artist. And to find your voice that's going to make a life for you, not just a success, not just a career, a life. And there are those who can do it, like Nina, who will survive, and those who can't, like Treplieff. And Chekhov is not saying you must do this in order to. He had no answers. And he tells us over and over, if only, if only, if only, the song of our lives, if only. So I leave you with those thoughts, which I think are terribly appropriate for those of you who are interested in the theater. Thank you.
Thank you. With the Eskimos.
Yes.
So the guy I sort of grew up in high school, and his name, Fred Miller, was in the program at Northwestern just before, and I think the first 2 years of. He talked about the Zelda of having, she must have been in what, the 80s? She was playing Zelda.
Oh my God, no, I didn't see it. The first production was, oh my God.
I was a green girl from the prairies, right? Started in Chicago. And I said, my God, what is this? This is incredibly fascinating stuff, right?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my word, such texture.
All the Krauss people I know.